I'm Brandi Cruz. Welcome to our series, Truth Tellers, the first of five episodes where we celebrate important truth tellers in Washington State and across the country. Today, we're featuring Anna Kasparian. Anna has been a nationally recognized political commentator for a long time, best known for her role as host on The Young Turks. But lately, she's been making headlines because Anna, who's described herself as a leftist, has come out very forcefully against some of the progressive policies that have devastated states like California.
Definitely be honest about my own flaws and my own mistakes because I bought the mainstream media narrative that there wasn't a migrant crisis.
For far too long, the Democratic Party has been terrified of these little mobs of people, these little mobs of activists.
I'm done with the identitarian garbage. I'm done with it. It is a giant distraction. And the more we focus on it, and it's definitely very obvious to me when it comes to the left.
You can understand why people are frustrated at the corruption, at the loss of $24 billion that was allocated to help the homeless.
Dismembering a corpse and hiding a corpse after dismembering it, not bail eligible, not a serious crime.
So we're happy to have Anna on today and celebrate her as an important truth teller. Anna, welcome to Undivided.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, well, I just have to say, you dropped into my DMs and told me you love the show, and I almost cried. I was like, she knows who I am, and she watches the show, and it's just so nice because I was actually having a really bad week. It was like I'd had a bad week, a bad weekend, and you never know. Like, it really just cheered me up, and it gave me a lot of enthusiasm, and so I'm like, okay, maybe we're doing what we need to be doing. So thank you for that.
For sure. Yeah. I mean, I've told you this before, but I'll tell your audience that, you know, the experiences I had in Los Angeles were very alienating, especially when I wanted to address some of those policy issues with my side of the political aisle, and they just kind of weren't getting it. So hearing from another woman living in a big blue city, experiencing something similar, but also speaking out about it really provided some comfort at a time when I did feel super alienated.
Well, I appreciate that. And we're going to talk about your experiences and stuff. I'm assuming that most of our viewers and listeners know who you are, but just in case they don't, give them kind of your resume, if you will.
Sure. I'm the executive producer and host of The Young Turks. I've been at the company for 18 years, which is, every time I say that, it kind of blows my mind. And I basically started doing on-air work at 20. I'm now 38. So it gives you a sense of, you know, just think about how much you change and grow throughout that period of time in your life. And fortunately or unfortunately, I've done it in front of a camera. So there's a lot of baggage that comes along with that, a lot of consequences that come with that. But that's what my main job has been. But I've also done a lot of other projects, a lot of freelance work. I've done shows for other companies. And so I've just practically focused my energy in the media industry since graduating college.
Yeah. And you bring up that kind of, you know, if you're saying everything and pouring out your heart and being honest with people every single day on camera, inevitably some of your views are going to change over time and you have to make a decision. Do I own that and risk alienating my audience? Or do I just sort of keep doing what I've been doing? You know, you've been all over conservative media lately and they've been celebrating you and heralding you as this, you know, truth teller on the left, which I think you are. How much of the changes in sort of your worldview that have happened recently are a result of your personal experience in Los Angeles versus your experience covering politics?
I would say equally both. Covering politics, I think the most well-meaning individual will kind of take their side at face value. And unfortunately, there are certain narratives in this like filter bubble type media landscape that unfortunately kind of propagandizes you, even if you're doing your best not to buy into propaganda. And so it takes a lot of effort to kind of pierce through that bubble and listen to other perspectives. But by covering the news and hearing certain narratives on the left and then seeing them kind of renege on some of those narratives or at least do things that are hypocritical to the values they purport to have, that kind of started waking me up to things. And I think that maturity growing up, you know, you gain some wisdom and you kind of start to understand that people are complex, they're very complicated, and how they arrive at their political identity is really different for everyone, right? And so the assumption that everyone on the other side is a monolith and they're all bad people, I think was a terrible way to operate. And so for the last few years, I've kind of rejected that notion and have made a good faith effort to consume news that's presented by various perspectives. But more importantly, I've like reached out to people both privately and on camera to kind of understand their perspectives, how they arrived to the conclusions they've arrived to. And it's given me a more robust and comprehensive view of what our political landscape really looks like. You know, not everyone on the right, you know, is holding tiki torches and marching while saying the Jews will not replace us in Charleston. Okay, that's not indicative of all Trump supporters. And I think that, you know, there are some areas of common ground where I think the left and the right could work together. And I'm talking about the electorate here, and demand more from their elected lawmakers. But you would never know about those areas of common ground unless you're willing to have those conversations.
Yeah. Was it hard for you? I mean, did you have this internal struggle with, because when you make your living based off of your opinion like we do, you know, you cultivate an audience that I think for the most part just naturally agrees with your opinion on a lot of things. So did you have any internal struggle on coming out as forcefully as you have with some of the problems of the Democratic Party? Or was it never a question for you like, no, I'm just going to say what I feel?
In the beginning, of course, there's a lot of fear. You know what's coming. I expected a lot of the backlash I'm getting to happen. But to be honest with you, it's actually been a lot worse than I expected. And so I'm going through it right now. And so, you know, our audience has definitely suffered as a result. Our viewership has suffered as a result. We're going through that right now as we speak. I had a conversation with Glenn Beck recently. You know, Glenn Beck and I have many areas of disagreement, certainly when it comes to religion. I don't believe in organized religion. He clearly does. And some of that, you know, some of those religious values inform his political view. So naturally, there are going to be some differences. But I went into the conversation wanting to engage in like real discourse, a genuine exchange of values, ideas, where we stand, what we think would make the country better. And I enjoyed the conversation. But it was hilarious because one of our contributors was so offended that I would even have the audacity to speak to someone like Glenn Beck, that he did this whole performative spectacle of quitting TYT and claiming that I'm putting Black bodies' lives at risk. I think people are done with that. I'm done with that. Having a conversation does not put bodies at risk. And I would prefer to refer to individuals as people. But anyway, like that's some of the stuff that's been going on. And unfortunately, every time, you know, someone does that, they're going to take a portion of our audience along with them. But ultimately, I want to find my people. And by that, I mean, I want to foster an open-minded audience that's looking forward to hearing from conflicting and varying perspectives. That's what makes America great. And you're not going to come up with good solutions, policy solutions, if you're under the assumption that one side of the political aisle gets everything right and the other side of the political aisle gets everything wrong. In fact, what we've experienced locally has led me to really believe that there are a lot of policy prescriptions that the left has been pushing for, they've been implemented on a local level, and they're not great. They need to be recalibrated in the very least. And what's shocking is just this inability to ever accept, hey, maybe this policy was well-intentioned, but we do need to recalibrate so it works better.
Yeah. And I want to talk a lot about that because that's the real mind-boggling thing to me. Like we see it, we see what's happening. We see the numbers, we see it with our own eyes, and the inability to just say, you know what, that ain't it. It is shocking to me. You know, to your point about an audience, because we've experienced it a little bit, you know, from the further right, I guess, in Washington state, losing some people over support of particular candidates and more moderacy. And, you know, I almost think, though, that that's a stronger audience to build in the long run, like an audience that's independent minded and they aren't going to abandon you if you disagree with them on something. So is TYT, have they been supportive of, besides that one contributor, supportive of you sort of speaking these truths?
What's kept me at TYT as long as I've been there has been Cenk Uygur. And, you know, that's the CEO of the company, also my co-host on the main show. And I know that there are a lot of people who think he's terrible. He rubs them the wrong way. But put your personal feelings about him aside and at least give him credit for fostering a work environment where people are comfortable voicing their opinions, stating what their genuine analysis is without fear of retaliation from management. I've never once worried about getting fired because I have a different perspective on a political issue. And in fact, he and I have gotten into some pretty huge debates on camera. And afterwards, it's all love. Like, we have this mutual respect for each other. And honestly, I have mutual respect for everyone I work with. And what's really sad is when I notice that, you know, the respect that I'm treating everyone with isn't necessarily reciprocated based on my own personal values or my personal perspective on certain stories or certain policies. And I just don't know when it got to a point where, and it's not everyone on the left, I want to be clear about that, but there's certainly a faction of the left that is unwilling to even consider or hear the perspectives of someone they disagree with. And I think that's made the left weaker. It's made it less likely that they are able to defend their positions if they do, in fact, engage in a debate with, let's say, a right-wing media pundit or content creator. And I just don't think the left is doing itself any favors by shutting itself off from, you know, challenges to what they already believe.
The real estate market has been pretty slow, but that doesn't mean that you can't still get a great price for your home. So if you're thinking about selling your home in 2025, reach out to our friend Wes Jones of sellwithwes.com. Sellwithwes.com. Wes and his team have an innovative marketing strategy to make sure that your home stands out when it hits the market. He can also help make sure that any cosmetic upgrades to your home are made. He can manage those projects. They can even help you pay for it up front through something called their Listing Boost Concierge Service. So make sure you check that out. Go to their website, sellwithwes.com. Start by using their home value calculator to see how much your home is worth. It might be worth more than you think. Sellwithwes.com, a better way to sell your home. I have urged you guys to take the First Mark Challenge. Why? We all need insurance. Why else? We could all save a little bit of money. So many Undivided viewers and listeners throughout 2024 saved thousands upon thousands of dollars by doing the First Mark Challenge. What does it entail? Well, you schedule some time with First Mark, firstmarkinsurance.com, firstmarkinsurance.com. They'll go over all your current insurance plans with you, talk about your insurance needs, and then they'll go out, they'll shop the market for you, and they'll come back with their recommendations. Undivided viewer Sarah just finished the First Mark Challenge. She said, we're now saving over $1,100 annually for our auto and home combo. We did end up paying more for earthquake insurance than we are now, but First Mark told us our earthquake coverage was terrible, so we needed to pay a little more to know that we're properly covered should a quake happen. She said, I'm so glad I finally talked to them. My only complaint is that we should have made this change months ago. And I hear so many stories like that. So don't wait. Take the First Mark Challenge today. FirstMarkInsurance.com, FirstMarkInsurance.com. The very best part is they work for you. Did you notice how the market responded right after the election? Are you happy with how your retirement portfolio is positioned? Is your portfolio actively managed? Well, maybe it's time to get another perspective. It's always smart to get a second opinion when it comes to critical health decisions. Zach Abraham, Chief Investment Officer at Bulwark Capital Management, feels it's no different when it comes to the health of your retirement portfolio. You can get that second opinion with Bulwark's free Know Your Risk Portfolio Review, where they'll cover the impacts of the election, an outlook for 2025, plus a full reveal of how Bulwark is always looking for opportunities to lower risk, lower cost, and give your retirement as much upside as possible. You only get one retirement. Get a second opinion. Schedule your free portfolio review now at knowyourriskradio.com. That's knowyourriskradio.com. Do you feel like the left has almost been, I don't want to put words in your mouth, so if you disagree, that's fine, but more vitriolic towards you because it's like a betrayal versus the right that they already disagreed with you anyway?
Yes. And they, okay. So I think there's two things happening. Okay. So I think that among our audience, there are individuals who feel that I have betrayed the left, even though overwhelmingly, if you look at my policy stances, I mean, I'm still very much on the left. It's just that I don't buy into some of the criminal justice reform narratives that we heard following the protests and riots of 2020. Turns out that a lot of these policies have not worked out so well. Harm reduction policies are not reducing any harm. Okay, we have somewhere around 100,000 people dying of drug overdoses every year. And so this permissive approach is not working out so well because it's kind of shifting away from rehabilitation or detox. And so there are lots of people struggling with drug addiction who actually want rehabilitation, but since it's not as funded as it was previously, those options aren't as available to them. So these are issues that I bring up and I give my rationale, my reasoning for why I've changed my mind, but they see it as a betrayal anyway. And I don't know what to do about that other than continue moving forward with, you know, the facts. The facts are the facts. You can't change them. And so I don't know why we'd want to stick to policies that have already been proven to fail. We have to recalibrate. I mean, I think this past election was just a major data set proving that what I'm saying here is correct. So that's one side. They genuinely just see it as a betrayal. But then there's other left-wing content creators who have seen this as an opportunity to essentially cut corners and steal a portion of our audience by feeding into this narrative and making it bigger than it really is. So if you watch any of these left-wing content creators, if you watch the guy who just, the contributor who just left TYT, you would think I'm like, you know, hanging out with Richard Spencer and like Nick Fuentes or something. Like, it's ridiculous. Okay. Or that I'm like this giant Trump supporter, and none of those things are true. But I will say one of the other areas in which they're, you know, very uncomfortable with my conduct on air is that I'm just not interested in demonizing voters, period. Okay. I don't think Trump voters are evil. I don't think they're my enemy. How they've come to their conclusion that Trump is the best leader for them, I think that's an interesting question. And I want to learn more about that rather than shut them out of my life and treat them as if they're the enemy.
Yeah, there's so much. I mean, there's definitely the national political conversation, and then what I would deem sort of the West Coast political conversation. And a lot of what's wrong with the Democratic Party nationally, I think, is born out of these really misguided policies on the West Coast that sort of take over the conversation a little bit. You know, you mentioned, you know, things that you've seen in LA, the things we know to be true. These are facts, overdoses, crime, you know, what defund the police did and all of this stuff. When you get resistance from the left on some of the comments that you've made about those things, have you had anyone on the left who has articulated why you're factually wrong, why they believe you're factually wrong?
For the most part, no. It's usually the whole you're a traitor narrative comes
grifter.
Out, but or you're a right winger, you're a grifter, exactly. Even though, you know, we're losing audience members, and where am I grifting from? Like, where is the money coming from, allegedly? Like, it's a ridiculous narrative. But it's also, in my opinion, a way of skirting any substantive response or the ability to contend with what I'm even saying. And so there have been, I'll give you an example of one area of disagreement. And I don't know what's going on here because there's so much evidence and I keep showing the evidence again and again. But just this denial of the Venezuelan migrant crime issue. So first of all, they're very hyper-focused on what happened in Aurora, Colorado in regard to like a handful of apartment buildings. I've never said once that Venezuelan gangs have literally taken over Aurora, Colorado. Like, they move the goalposts and they pretend like I said something I didn't say. But it is true that there is a problem in Aurora, Colorado with migrant gangs. They'll respond with, well, Aurora's always had a problem with gangs. Okay. I get that we have our own homegrown criminals and we need to deal with that. But if they're here illegally and they're committing violent crimes and they're extorting people in their apartment units, they need to be prosecuted and then eventually deported. And I have no problem saying that. Okay, I don't think that makes anyone a bad person. The idea that American taxpayers should use up any of their resources on people who are in the country illegally committing crimes is insane. And so that's been like one of the areas where they just deny that it's even happening. And it's kind of driving me crazy, I got to be honest.
Yeah, it's frustrating. And I've had a few Democrats on. I had a Democratic Congressman, Adam Smith, which, if you've never talked to him, he's such a good guest because he's hilarious, but he just does not give a f- what he says about the Democrats. I mean, he was even, so he's been very a defender of Israel, and he's the ranking member on the House Armed Services Committee. And he said his house was being attacked here in Washington State by some left wingers who didn't like, you know, his support of Israel. And he admitted on our show to sitting inside thinking, well, this wouldn't be happening if Donald Trump was the mayor of my city, you know. And so he's just this interesting guy. But I guess I wonder, so I've been trying, I had him on, and one of the questions I asked him is, you know, we have all these issues that you have in LA here, and they're the predominant crises that we're facing. Yet we have all the elected leaders here who focus on, like, Donald Trump bad, you know, abortion rights in jeopardy, when our abortion rights have been codified since the 1970s in Washington. So is the unwillingness, I guess, to either vote differently or vote, you know, same party, but people who are willing to acknowledge the problems. I mean, where is that unwillingness coming from, do you think?
Well, for the broad left, or if you want to say, you know, the so-called like far left, I think it's really about the activism identity that they've taken on. And so when you see yourself as more of an activist, as opposed to someone who's supposed to give accurate analysis based on fact-based reporting, well, there's going to be a lot of tension. So I think, you know, in regard to the activist class within the left wing, that's what's transpiring. When it comes to the politicians, they're terrified, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. I think they're terrified of the activists. Okay, because these activists, I don't know if you have the same situation going down in Seattle, but in Los Angeles, they show up to every city council meeting.
Yep.
They're very threatening.
Yep.
Okay, they're very loud. And I think that they provide a very skewed vision of how Angelenos are feeling about things like, you know, immigration, or illegal immigration specifically, or crime, encampments, all of that, open air drug markets. I know for a fact, just based on what happened in this last election locally, that the vast majority of people living in LA do not agree with the far left policies that have been implemented by our local lawmakers. Yet the people they hear from the most are the activists who show up to these government functions and these city council meetings. You know, Mayor London Breed of San Francisco, who just lost her reelection bid, I remember when she started to get a little tough on cracking down on open air drug markets and things like that. As she was giving an outdoor press conference, one of these activists literally hurled a brick at her.
Yeah.
I mean, they're under threat if they dare to deviate even a little bit from the, again, I think well-intentioned but poorly implemented policies that came out of the protests of 2020. We need police, okay? We need police who are better trained. We also need a prison system that actually rehabilitates people. And so I'm totally in favor of prison reform. But what I woke up to in recent years is a lot of these activists aren't about reforming the system so it rehabilitates people, so we lessen the chances of recidivism. They really just want to abolish the system overall, meaning do away with the prisons, do away with the police, just have social workers respond to, you know, crimes. It's just not a smart idea. We haven't even done that. We haven't even gotten that far. But just the number of police retiring early, or the failure to recruit new police officers as a result of the job being less desirable as a result of those protests, you know, that police shortage has had devastating ramifications, locally speaking. And so we should learn from that and move forward in a way that makes sense, that actually values public safety, but also understands that there are instances where police can go too far. So what can we do to mitigate that?
Yeah. And to me, that's always been the solution here, is we have to quiet the influence of that really fringe minority. That is the same people who've been doing this kind of stuff for at least 10 years in Seattle. I mean, even longer than that, probably, and really bullying its way into trying to silence common sense solutions to things. So I guess in California, I mean, I'm envious of your election results and you know, some of the DAs that lost their jobs and the soft on crime leaders that lost their jobs. Do you think that that is a sign of things to come, or is it a blip? Because in Seattle, we've had shifts in the city council. You know, we had a shift from a pretty far left city council with a bona fide socialist to now a moderate city council, all Democrats still. But and then this past election, they turned around and they sent an actual socialist to the state house in Olympia to make laws for all of us. So when I see what happened in California, like, it gives me hope. But from the inside, do you think it's an anomaly or is it a sign of a shift?
Well, I do think it's a sign of a shift. And if the situation on the ground doesn't improve, I do think that there's a chance that California could potentially even become a swing state. I know that sounds crazy, but Trump flipped 10 blue counties to red counties in California alone. Mm-hmm. And to me, that definitely stems from just the disorder, the sense that people are unsafe, you know, and I understand that the perspective or the perception of being unsafe is different from what the statistics might actually bear out. But the statistics aren't great. Okay, let's keep it real. And anyone who decides to point to the 90s to make a point about how crime isn't as bad as the 90s, like literally the like one of the worst periods in terms of crime spikes, you're not making a good argument, okay? We still have not seen crime go down to pre-2019 levels in places like Los Angeles and San Francisco. And sure, you can make the argument that some violent crimes have decreased, but it's not just about violent crime. If you're a working class person living in the like the most expensive state in the country because of taxes and because of housing, having your $2,000 catalytic converter stolen is devastating. You know, every time I renew my car insurance, 2 years in a row, no tickets, no car accidents, but my car insurance keeps doubling. And it's because of street takeovers. It's because of catalytic converter thefts. It's because of vehicle thefts. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. So we're all paying a price. We're all subsidizing the criminality in our state. And it's unfair. And a lot of people living here have woken up to that and they want changes.
I'm glad you brought up the thing about crime stats, because nothing pisses me off more. It's like, it's almost offensive to me when a leader say, well, yeah, but we're not at the murder rate we were in 1994, or Washington and Seattle still have a relatively low crime rate compared to like Detroit and Baltimore. It's like, yeah, but we're not supposed to be comparing ourselves to Detroit and Baltimore. Like, we're supposed to be a world-class city. And, you know, don't tell me to feel safe because of where the crime was at 30 years ago. That doesn't make me feel any more safe. It's just such an odd thing. I'm curious about your belief or not belief in something we talk a lot about, which is the homeless industrial complex. You know, we're spending more money on homelessness here than ever before, yet it's worse than ever before. We started a regional homelessness authority. They just keep throwing hundreds of millions of dollars at it. And we have had a 22% increase in homelessness since it began a few years ago. And California has similar programs. We talked on the show about a woman who I think it's the LA sort of version of that, the LA homelessness authority, who gets paid like $328,000 a year. And then beneath her, there's all these like, you know, $250,000 a year salaries. And a point I was making about that is I don't think someone who has a government job for $350,000 a year has an incentive to solve homelessness, because then her job goes away. I mean, is that unfair? Do you believe that there's too much money being pumped into that system?
Well, Californians lost $24 billion because of this, you know, public-private nonprofit partnership that we have here, which essentially doles out government funds and grants to these nonprofits. And look, these nonprofits, you're right. I mean, they wouldn't exist if homelessness were solved, if we actually found real solutions for it. And so there have been audits indicating that very specific nonprofits had been, you know, squandering the money on themselves. Like, the executives were basically spending the money on themselves, lavish trips, things like that. There's like countless stories about that. $24 billion unaccounted for. God. Okay. And it really does enrage me. And look, I still believe that there are certain things that should not have a profit motive, right? I think healthcare is a good example of that, because if there is a profit motive, well, then you're going to have health insurance companies make decisions about whether or not to cover care for their patients. You know, depending on how expensive it is, depending on whether or not it's going to hurt their bottom line. When it comes to the homeless industrial complex, it's the same thing. Just because they're nonprofits doesn't mean that these aren't like, they're like companies functioning as if they're maximizing their profits. The thing is, the profits don't go to their shareholders. The profits go to their employees and their executives. And so there have been other instances where the homeless services that they've been caught carrying out are just like passing out literal pipes and syringes to people in these homeless encampments. I don't really see how that helps homeless people. And this idea that, I remember getting into a big debate about the little tiny home communities because, look, fact of the matter is we have so many people living on the streets here in California. We're not going to be able to build our way out of it. Now, do we need to build more housing? Absolutely. But the problem that we're seeing on the street isn't just about people being unable to afford housing. It's also due to severe mental illness and also drug addiction. But I think that these nonprofits are very intentionally pursuing a one-size-fits-all housing first policy because they know the housing first policy is never going to solve this issue. They're never going to be able to build enough housing in time to deal with this. But more importantly, they know that this is a much more complex issue than, oh, we just need to put someone in an apartment unit or into a shelter. These are people who have different unique issues at play. And so we need a much more, you know, comprehensive approach. And that comprehensive approach makes a lot of people on the left uncomfortable. It would involve forcing institutionalization of people who have severe mental health issues like paranoid schizophrenia and are unable to take care of themselves or make good decisions for themselves. It would have to bring back something like drug courts, which were working really well in California prior to 2020, which give drug offenders who break the law as a result of their, you know, addiction, the option of either serving time behind bars or you can go to rehabilitation, inpatient rehabilitation. And that program actually helped a lot of people in the past. But now with this kind of soft on everything mentality that we're seeing in the state, they don't even have to make those decisions. So they're never forced into rehab and they're free to continue using the very drug that's killing them slowly on our streets.
All right, the new year is upon us. That means you might be making some sort of New Year's resolution. How many of you are planning on making a New Year's resolution to lose weight or get healthy? We particularly feel that pressure after the holidays because let's be honest, there's a lot of food intake involved in the holidays and you might be feeling less than ideal, like you put on a few pounds, low on energy. Well, I have something that you can do for yourself today. Schedule a free 15-minute consultation with Dr. Ryan Coogan and his team over at Eastside Weight Loss Clinic. I lost 30 pounds in 2 months on the Eastside Weight Loss Clinic program, and I've been able to keep it off for 2 years through some simple, healthy lifestyle changes. There's no drugs, no injections, no strenuous workout routines. They just teach you what to eat in the right portions and how to take steps to keep the weight off for life. So do what I did, what so many other Undivided viewers and listeners have done. Schedule your free 15-minute consultation with Dr. C today. EastsideWeightLossClinic.com. That's EastsideWeightLossClinic.com. We all know that it's a difficult political environment for landlords, big and small, in Washington state. With new restrictions, new bills, new requirements, new taxes, you need to make sure that you have someone in your corner as a landlord to help you navigate this environment. Become a member of RHA today, the Rental Housing Association of Washington. RHAWA.org, RHAWA.org. It's about $260 a year. And not only do they advocate for landlords every single year when it comes to policymaking decisions, so you're helping when you become a member with that kind of work, but they're also going to be in your corner as a landlord, help you navigate the legalese, the difficult world of regulations that can vary city to city, county to county, and obviously state to state. So especially if you're a small to mid-sized landlord and you don't want to go it in this political environment on your own, become a member of RHA today. RHAWA.org, RHAWA.org. Undivided is sponsored in part by Future 42, making Washington a place for all to prosper. If you're frustrated by the results of the last election or frustrated by the direction of what's happening in Washington state, sign up for Future 42's newsletter to be alerted to opportunities to turn that frustration into action and actively get involved in making our communities and our state a better place. Future42.org, Future42.org. I want to wake people up to that because I really believe that if you fundamentally care about the homeless and actually improving their circumstances, we should demand accountability right, left, and center for every dime of that money. And for some reason, the left is like, oh no, like we'll keep passing more taxes to go to this failed system. We'll keep signing off on it. I guess I just really struggle with it because I don't know what it's going to take to wake people up. I mean, I have no idea.
Well, the activists and the nonprofits that are really gaining from this tragedy, from this crisis, become a lot less influential on our politicians once politicians start losing elections because they continue supporting these failed policies. So, you know, I was of two minds on election night. A lot of people were like, oh, Anna looks happy. And the truth is, I was, but mostly in regard to what was happening locally, mostly in regard to the electoral results in California, because losing 10 counties to Trump has got to wake up politicians in California. The passage of Prop 36, oh, please inject that into my veins. So Prop 36 reversed some of the brain rot that was implemented as a result of 2014's Prop 47. And that lessened penalties for things like shoplifting. But more importantly, aside from that, what Prop 47 did was it reclassified all sorts of felonies into misdemeanors. And that included things like domestic violence in the form of strangulation. That was a felony. It was reclassified to a misdemeanor. And, you know, I understand why a lot of Republican voters like to point fingers at left-wing voters and say, haha, you voted for this. But I would just caution them because the voters had no idea that they were going to reclassify violent felonies as misdemeanors. No one was aware of that. And, you know, when it comes to ballot initiatives, you typically are not getting what you think you're going to get. You know, there's all sorts of, you know, trickery taking place. And Prop 47 was a perfect example of that. So Prop 36 gave us an opportunity to reverse some of the damage. And I was so happy to see that about 70% of voters in the state of California approved Prop 36.
Yeah, it was overwhelming. You mentioned on election night, you know, people were saying you almost looked happy, but it was more so for California results. You did not vote for Donald Trump. You did not vote for Kamala Harris, correct?
Correct.
So yeah. Why didn't you vote for Harris?
Well, I think that Kamala Harris, I have a lot of issues with Kamala Harris. My main issue was that she really failed to be authentic and share a vision for the future of this country. She, to me, appeared to be an empty vessel. She didn't stand for anything. I despise neoconservatism. And so the fact that she was like parading around town with like Dick Cheney and Liz Cheney and talking about how honored she was to be endorsed by Dick Cheney, I was like, this is not someone who shares my values. So why would I vote for her? I get that the, you know, thinking is, well, she's a Democrat, so you're supposed to vote for the Democrat. No, I'm not supposed to vote for the Democrat. I'm not going to cast my ballot for someone who has failed to make a case for herself. And look, it really bothered me that she was anointed, that she was running a campaign, especially in the second half of her campaign, focusing on Donald Trump's alleged fascism and how he doesn't value democracy. And it's like, do you think Democrats value democracy? Because in 2016, during the primaries, we all saw what the DNC did to Bernie Sanders, preventing him from even having a shot, a real chance at beating Hillary Clinton in the primaries. And then, you know, they denied that, denied. And then in this election cycle, you had some Democratic lawmakers come out of the woodwork and admit that there was an intentional, orchestrated effort to ensure that Bernie Sanders didn't have a chance, that Hillary Clinton, you know, it was her turn, that she would be the Democratic nominee. That's not very Democratic, if you ask me. And anointing the Democratic nominee after Biden dropped out, also not very Democratic. So I had a lot of issues with her. And, you know, like every time she got confronted by protesters, she thought that just brushing them off and saying, I'm speaking, was good enough. But no, that's not good enough. I can understand being frustrated at the confrontation that she was consistently dealing with. But people want to know, how do you intend to deal with the very real foreign policy concerns that are taking place right now and are very likely to explode even further? And she didn't have any answers for that.
Yeah, you know, she's really young still, obviously, and politics has become her career. I don't think politics should be a career, but here we are. And there's all these headlines out about how she's mulling whether to run for governor of California or to mount another presidential bid in 2028. Do you think either of those are a realistic possibility or a good idea?
I think there's a good chance that she's going to run for governor of California, and I would be devastated if she won. California needs real leadership, and Kamala Harris has not really shown herself to be the type of leader this state needs. She didn't show herself to be the type of leader the country needs. And so I don't know how you can lose an election as dramatically as she just lost and think, oh, no, I'm going to go ahead and try to run a state that can literally be equated as like the fifth largest economy in the world.
Yeah.
Okay.
Like, yeah.
What? This is not a good idea. So I don't know how that would play out, but I'm really hoping that she changes her mind and, you know, does what most politicians do after losing an election. They usually go into the public sector, a private sector, I should say, as a lobbyist or a consultant.
Yeah, it seems, because it's hard, because in a state like yours, similar to ours, if the Democratic Party decides this is our person and sort of anoints them, like our governor-elect here, nobody had a chance on the Democratic side to really run a campaign against him. Then, you know, Republicans are probably not going to win the governorship in California, so that's sort of who you're going to get. On Donald Trump, I mean, obviously, you know, you didn't vote for him, and your whole life of politics explains why, but do you think anything in terms of the warnings about Trump, the concerns from, you know, what he did the first time around, do you think any of that has been overblown?
Well, I mean, look, he did try to implement a fake elector scheme. I know a lot of the attention has been on the January 6th rioters. And while I don't agree with what they did, I certainly don't think that that was the biggest issue. To me, the biggest issue was the very real strategy that was being implemented, that was taking place behind the scenes with the fake elector scheme. And, you know, now that Trump has won the election, he doesn't really have to worry about, you know, the prosecution of his involvement with the fake elector scheme. But a lot of the fake electors are being prosecuted. So that's very much real. And that bothers me the most about Trump, actually. That was the main reason why I couldn't even consider casting my ballot for him, because look, regardless of whether you like Trump or hate Trump, what's really important is that we maintain what we have left of our democratic process. I would like to enhance it further. I would like to make our democratic process even better, but maybe even implement some reforms. But fact of the matter is, what makes this country great and what I believe makes it work, with all these different people from all around the world coming together with different cultures and faiths, is that we get to voice our opinion at the ballot box. And he lost the 2020 election. The other thing, and tell me what you think about this.
Yeah.
I am not like most leftists in regard to like gender roles, right? Like, I like strong men. Okay. I love strong men. And so for me, seeing him refuse to accept defeat was a show of weakness. And I didn't like that. So I just wish he would have accepted that he lost the election. And do I think he's going to stay in office and refuse to leave now that he's been elected? I'm really not worried about that, but I hope he doesn't prove me wrong. So we'll see.
Yeah. And I in 2020, you know, I got booed out of a room. I was invited to speak to conservative women of Washington, and you know, they asked me some questions and I said, of course, Trump lost the 2020 election. It's the first room I've ever been like booed out of. I mean, I didn't leave. I wasn't booed out of the room, but there was like probably an 80-year-old woman in the front row who stood up. If you've never been booed by an 80-year-old woman aggressively, it's a really humiliating experience. She's like, boo. I'm just like, oh my God.
Oh my
God.
Gosh.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of things Trump has said that I don't like. And that for a long time kept me from appreciating the things about him that I now do like, and some of the policy things and the team that he's building. You know, I think the left is a little like poo-poo on the weird sort of coalition he's built, like with Elon and Tulsi and RFK. And it's like, but when you really stop and think about it, these are people who have disagreed on a lot over the years, and now they're coming together and sort of coming up with a plan to save aspects of the country. And I really think that's exciting. I'm excited about some of those things. I do wish Trump would a little more,
yes,
and just do some of the things that need to be done. But yeah, I mean, I voted for him for the first time. I hope I don't live to regret it, but I feel pretty optimistic about it. I want to talk to you quick about the culture wars, because I really, I struggle with this. For instance, today we're starting our show with, I guess, what people could characterize as a culture war. We have a $14 billion budget deficit we're facing here, yet they're posting jobs for doctors to provide gender-affirming care to prison inmates for, like, you know, what is it, $300,000 a year or something? And it's like, to me, you know, it's just, it's ridiculous. I cannot deal with some of the identity-obsessed spending with the government and focus in our public schools. I mean, to what extent, like, who do you think has mishandled the sort of culture war issues more? Do you think Republicans talk about it too much as a bad thing, or that Democrats push it too much?
I really do think that both parties are guilty of engaging in this. And so when it comes to our politicians, right, when it comes to that level of culture war discourse, I do feel that oftentimes both parties engage in it as a distraction, and it's a great way to divide and conquer. And so we're all at each other's throats about these culture war issues. And in the meantime, you know, there's a lot of cronyism happening because these are the very politicians who deregulate and allow the cronyism to happen, who want to turn a blind eye to violations of antitrust policies and things like that. And so one of the main areas where I think I'm clashing with a faction of the left is I want to focus our energy on universal economic policies that make people's lives better, okay, period. And when you start fragmenting coalitions by hyper-focusing on identities, you're not going to win jack shit. Sorry for my language, but it's just true. And so I see a left that's so disempowered right now because everyone on the left is more concerned about what their personal identity group is going to get, as opposed to what can we do to come together, fight together for universal policies that are probably going to disproportionately benefit the very groups that we're talking about here anyway. But the magic of universal policy is that everyone who could benefit from it does benefit from it. And it leads to policies that have more lasting power, a lot more, you know, public approval. And so that's kind of like where my head is at. But in regard to who's more guilty of engaging in the culture wars, I think both parties certainly are. You know, I'll give you an example. Like Nancy Mace, I think she's a Republican lawmaker in the House. I think she realized, you know, the Trump campaign's ad on transgender surgeries for undocumented detainees did really well. Maybe this is my chance to kind of piggyback off of that with an incoming transgender lawmaker who just got elected. And I really didn't like the way she handled that, because it was focusing on one incoming lawmaker who's transgender. And she said, look, I'll use my personal bathroom. I don't want this to become a big deal. Let's just drop it. Like, let's not make this a big deal. I want to focus on other policies. But Nancy Mace was unwilling to drop it. She's like, I don't want her using my bathroom. I don't want her going into the women's bathroom. And so to me, that is a good example of a politician exploiting a culture war issue, something very provocative, something very contentious, not because she genuinely cares about her, like she's genuinely concerned about her safety due to this one lawmaker.
She got assaulted over it. So,
I mean, she did, yes. But like anyone who assaults anyone should be prosecuted for that. But there was no indication that this one individual who was like at the center of everything Nancy Mace was saying posed a threat to Nancy Mace in any way. And in fact, like, it just felt gross to kind of attack one person in the way that she was, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. And I'm very much in the camp of, as an adult, do what makes you happy and live your life. You only get one life. Just, I don't want it to be forced upon me or you to suggest that because I don't believe that a man can be a woman that and or should compete against women, that makes me a hateful bigot. That's what bothers me. I think that's one of the reasons I can't drop the culture war issue, is because it's some of these things are so stupid to me. Some of like the treatment of J.K. Rowling and, you know, this idea that biological men, it's perfectly fine and no big deal, does not give them an advantage to compete against women is so utterly stupid to me that I just feel like we can't move forward as a country until the majority of people who understand that that doesn't make sense can take over the conversation. We can move forward. I just feel like I need some closure to some of these dumb culture war issues so we don't have a segment of the country that just gets away with pretending that this stuff makes sense. Does that make sense?
Of course. No, I mean, look, I totally get it. And I have my own, you know, I guess you can call it a culture war issue. I mean, certainly when we talk about criminal justice reform, some people see that as a culture war issue, right? And so I'm not dropping that because I actually see real harm being done by the way some of these policies have been implemented. And the same can be true when it comes to policies surrounding, you know, the transgender community and how they should be included in certain areas of life, especially when it comes to sex segregated spaces and women's sports. And look, I just, the part of this that bothers me the most is that I don't think that you're even allowed to have a conversation, even if you're someone who's generally supportive of transgender people. And I am. I have been historically. My career bears that out. But I don't think that it's a black and white issue. And I do think there are areas of tension as it pertains to female segregated spaces and as it pertains to, you know, women's sports. It doesn't necessarily mean that transgender women have to be excluded in every case, but there needs to be a standard. And who gets to decide those standards? Should it be the sports leagues? Should it be legislation? I don't know. But the worst part about all of it is raising the question at all and wanting to have a good faith conversation about it at all automatically makes you a transphobe, according to, you know, some factions of the left. And I don't think that's helpful at all. In fact, I think it's actually led to backlash, unfair backlash toward the trans community in some cases.
Yeah, we need to be able to have the conversation. That's kind of where I want to bring it with you, because I really enjoyed the interview you did with Glenn Beck. And one of the things I noticed, like, from the jump is you were both politely but challenging the wording that the other would use and seeking clarity on, okay, what do you mean? You know, he asked you, what do you mean when you call yourself left wing? And he was using the phrase Marxist. And you're like, okay, I don't agree with, you know, this broad use of the phrase Marxist, which I agree is overused as well. And I liked that. I noticed it right away because I don't think we do that enough. And like, okay, what do you mean when you say that? And then you kind of come to a better understanding of where the other person's coming from, like putting a check on the language they're using. So I guess for you, as you've been embarking on this kind of conservative media tour, you know, because we're all so fascinated with you know, what you've been saying lately, what is the advice you have for other people who genuinely do want to engage in a conversation on these issues with someone who they don't agree with on a lot of things?
Well, I would say, first and foremost, don't cave into the urge or maybe even outside pressure to own the other side. Mm-hmm. If you're really coming into the conversation for your personal mental enrichment, in order to learn more about the other side, or in order to genuinely share your ideas, you know, with a new audience, keep in mind that that audience is not going to be receptive to anything you have to say if you're coming at the interview with this combative, I'm going to beat you state of mind, right? And so I also want to just say, I think when people do that, it's not even about doing anything productive. It's more about a personal marketing ploy to get the right sound bites to go back to their show and pat themselves on the back for owning whoever they were talking to. There was a time in my life and career where I was interested in that. I'm not really interested in that anymore. I think the country desperately needs to heal, and it's not going to heal unless we have conversations with each other, but real heartfelt conversations where we respect each other, where we understand each other. We might disagree, and I certainly disagree with Glenn Beck. There's no question about that. But I was actually really surprised to see that there were a lot of areas of agreement where I would have never thought in a million years there would be agreement. So hearing Glenn Beck speak out against some of the foreign policies during the Bush era, admitting that he was wrong about those policies, that was great. I really respect him for saying that. You know, he spoke out against corporate greed. He spoke out against the pharmaceutical industries and how insanely greedy they are and how they've been, you know, price gouging the American people. I really respect hearing a conservative say those things, because these are the types of things, you know, left wingers have been saying forever. And if we now have this area of common ground, excellent. How can we move forward, work together to make the system, make these policies a lot better? That's where my head is at right now. But I will say, it's kind of shocking how offensive people find that. Like, people do not like it.
So bothersome.
They do want, they want you to kind of just engage in like this fight, this constant fight. I don't know, man. I'm exhausted. I really am. And I've been engaging in that fight for so long, and it has yielded no results. And so what do I want to do in the world? Like, what do I want my story to be? What do I want my contribution to be? And I do think that a huge part of my career kind of focused on this divisive rhetoric that wasn't helpful. And so I don't want to look back at my career and feel good about myself because I caused more division. I want to look back at my career and say, I found these areas of common ground and I persuaded my side to work with the other side to accomplish this. And it actually made lives better. That's what I want to do with the work that I'm putting out there.
Yeah. And you must know how important it's been. And I think all of these interviews that you do and the Glenn Beck one, I mean, talk about like changing hearts and minds, and it happens slowly, but I think that's the kind of thing that can start to actually get people focused on the issues that matter, dealing with them in a way that's meaningful. It means a lot coming from someone like you to be introspective about what's going on. We need more people on the right to be introspective about some of the policies that they're pushing or not pushing. So Anna, keep being a truth teller. I so appreciate you taking the time to chat with us. I know our audience will just love this conversation. We'd love to have you back on sometime.
Thank you so much, Brandy. Love what you're doing. Keep it up.
That has been episode one of our series, Truth Tellers. Coming up on episode two, we're going to speak with Cliff Mass. Cliff Mass is a professor of atmospheric sciences at the University of Washington, and he's been telling simple truths about some of the climate policies being pushed in Washington State and beyond. And there's no doubt those truths have angered some on the left and also some in the media. So we look forward to having that conversation with Cliff coming up on the next edition of Truth Tellers. Well, you can watch Truth Tellers for free across all of our platforms. We would appreciate your support for Undivided. You can sign up for just $5 a month by going to undividedpod.com. That's undividedpod.com.